Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Anand Gopal, author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes, who explains why he believes U.S. collaboration with brutal Afghan warlords has bred resentment and instability. Marge Baker of People for the American Way, who talks about her group's support for a proposed constitutional amendment that would reverse recent Supreme Court rulings by permitting the regulating of money in election campaigns. And Seattle Socialist City Council member Shama Sawant, who discusses the successful campaign she led that won a $15 minimum wage in Seattle, the highest minimum pay rate in the nation. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Retired Libyan General Khalifa Haftar, with ties to the old Gaddafi regime and the 2011 uprising, is now leading an armed campaign against his nation's Islamists. The retired general, who spent years in exile in the United States, has repeatedly attacked Islamic militias in Benghazi. His troops have also attacked the pro-Islamic parliament, called the General National Congress, as it was set to vote on the oil-rich nation's budget. Despite his checkered history, thousands of Libyans and members of the National Army are flocking to support Haftar's self-proclaimed war on terrorism. Supporters have rallied in Benghazi, the hub of Islamic militias and the Muslim Brotherhood, and in the capital city of Tripoli. In recent days, Haftar has proclaimed that the interim Prime Minister Ahmed Matik is illegitimate. In the midst of his military campaign in eastern Libya, Haftar has called for a delay in the planned June 25th election, which was called to defuse the crisis. Haftar says the parliamentary election must be delayed for months, telling Reuters, "The time is not right while we are fighting terrorism." Colombia's hardline candidate Oscar Iván Zuluaga edged out incumbent President Juan Manuel Santos in the first round of national elections, which took place on May 25th. The rise of Zuluaga endangers the ongoing peace talks with the rebel army, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, to end the 50-year civil war that has killed more than 200,000 people. Zuluaga is a close ally of former President Alvaro Uribe, who ignored peace talks while seeking to militarily defeat the FARC. Zuluaga and Santos are now battling for support from the Conservative Party, whose candidate came in third place in the first round of elections. Meanwhile, negotiations with the FARC in Havana are on hold, awaiting the outcome of the June 15th runoff election. In mid-May, the government and the FARC signed a critical agreement where the guerrilla army said it would stop all drug trafficking activities in exchange for the government ordering a halt to its U.S.-funded aerial herbicide spraying program over FARC-controlled jungles. On election night, Santos, a former defense minister under Uribe, told supporters, "Colombians have two options between those who prefer an end to the war and those who want a war without end." New questions are surfacing about how the American Red Cross spent the $312 million it raised in donations to aid victims of Superstorm Sandy. Thus far, the Red Cross has refused to disclose to the public how the money was spent. The charity has released general aid summaries, but not a detailed accounting of its emergency relief efforts. In the aftermath of disasters, including the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the response to Hurricane Katrina, Red Cross executives were fired related to unanswered questions about how the organization's funds were spent. Doug White, an expert on nonprofit governance at Columbia University, told ProPublica, "The Red Cross is too big and too important to be allowed to be this secretive." In 2013, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman requested detailed financial records from the American Red Cross. Yet even after a settlement was reached between Schneiderman and the Red Cross, detailed financial records relating to the response to Sandy victims has not been disclosed to the public. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker. We'll be right back.
America's longest war in Afghanistan will not end in 2014, as President Obama had earlier pledged. When Mr. Obama visited U.S. troops deployed in Afghanistan on May 25th, he announced that while most of the 32,800 American combat soldiers there would be coming home by the end of the year, a force of 10,000 would likely remain to conduct counterterrorism operations and train Afghan soldiers and police. 2 days later, back in Washington, the president filled in the details of his plan to leave 9,800 troops in Afghanistan in December and reduce that number by half by the end of 2015, moving to a small support force by the time he leaves office in January 2017. While the Afghan military is slated to take full responsibility for their nation's security, many observers are wary of their capability to fend off attacks by the determined Taliban guerrilla movement. But as Afghanistan holds the second round of its presidential election on June 14th, the impoverished country continues to face many internal threats, including widespread corruption and the indiscriminate violence at the hands of powerful warlords. As the U.S. media focuses attention on the controversy that recently erupted after the Obama administration's trade of 5 Taliban prisoners held in Guantanamo in exchange for the only remaining U.S. prisoner of war held in Afghanistan, journalist Anand Gopal has been warning of the dangerous legacy of toxic U.S. alliances there. Your reporter spoke with Gopal, a former Afghan correspondent and author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes, who explains why he believes U.S. collaboration with brutal Afghan warlords has bred resentment and instability.
Really, since the beginning in 2001, what the U.S. has done is look for short-term security over the long-term process of building the Afghan state. And really, at the end of the day, if we want to defeat the Taliban, we need a strong Afghan state. We need one that respects human rights, that respects the rights of individuals. But instead, the U.S. allied with a whole set of warlords and power brokers, and they did that because these people were very effective at killing Taliban. Unfortunately, they're also effective at killing non-Taliban, meaning killing civilians, but we've sort of looked the other way to let that happen in the interest of short-term goals.
Can you describe for our listeners some of the incidents that you witnessed firsthand while reporting in Afghanistan that convinced you that the United States should break their ties with these warlords?
Well, I'll give you an example of one prominent commander whose name is Azizullah, who operates near the Afghan-Pakistani border. And Azizullah has no government role. He's not a member of the police or the army. He's really just like essentially a private security contractor who's paid by the U.S. Special Forces. And he's been known for very many crimes, including summarily executing people. In one instance, he took 2 people whom he suspected of being Taliban and tied them to the back of his truck and drove it around the countryside until the people were dead. In another instance, he and his militia men gang raped a young boy, and there's many other cases like this. The United Nations, in fact, sent a communique to the U.S. military, basically outlining a lot of his crimes and pleading for the U.S. to drop their support of him. But to this day, the U.S. continues to support him because they view him as being somebody who's strong in the fight against the Taliban.
What do you believe to be the short-term and long-term consequences of the United States' alliance with these warlords, both in the lead-up to the withdrawal of the majority of U.S. troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year, and then after that, when the security of the country is the responsibility of the Afghan military?
The short-term consequences of these sorts of alliances is that, you know, we have a pretty horrific human rights situation in the countryside, that the people that we are supporting are really no better than the Taliban that we're fighting, which is a major problem just on an ethical level. Also on a political or strategic level, this creates the very enemies that one day would turn around and go and take up their guns and fight against U.S. soldiers or fight against the Afghan government, because people don't just wake up one day and decide to join the Taliban. The Taliban by themselves aren't very popular in the countryside, but when you have these sort of predatory warlords and strongmen, people will join the Taliban as a way of protecting themselves, and that's something we've seen over the last 10 years. And in this way, the U.S. has indirectly fueled the conflict. In the long term, what this does, beyond just having a massive insurgency, is it also weakens the Afghan state, because instead of having a strong government that exists everywhere, what you have is a weak government that's sitting in the cities, and then you have surrounding that, a large number of warlords and strongmen who really owe their power and their money to their connections to the U.S. forces.
What, in your view, is the best way for the United States to break off ties with these warlords, given that U.S. officials maintain the rationale that these warlords are necessary to keep the peace in Afghanistan, even to the point where U.S. special forces are collaborating with these warlords and their militias and even protecting them?
I think we need to start by shifting away from the immediate short-term perspective to a more medium-term and long-term perspective. So that means that cutting off all funding and ties to these warlords, but you can't just, you know, cut off ties and have them sit there, because what they'll do is they'll continue. Once you have the guns, it's very hard to take it away from them. They're going to continue preying on the population. What needs to be done is they should be cut off from their funding and then absorbed into the Afghan security forces. You know, put uniforms on them, train them, make them go to the Afghan government for their paycheck, make them accountable. You know, if they commit a crime, that they actually could be hauled in front of a court. You know, make them accountable to the structures of the legal structures of the Afghan government. All of that needs to happen, but the first step has to be that the U.S. has to sever its ties, because if it doesn't, then even if they get absorbed into the Afghan government, they kind of have their own power base. They don't need to go to the government for their paycheck.
Anand, in your book, No Good Men Among the Living, you focus on the perception of these many years of war among average Afghans. And I would ask you, speaking to an American audience, what have you come away with from your years of reporting on Afghanistan to understand the legacy of this war, both for Afghans and the United States?
The real legacy for the average Afghan, particularly those who live in the countryside, is one where there is very little state presence, where they're caught between the Taliban on one side and pro-American warlords on the other side. With really no way to be neutral, no way to have protection from these two forces. Unfortunately, that seems to be the enduring legacy of our involvement there.
That was journalist Anand Gopal, a former Afghan correspondent and author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Find more analysis and commentary on the Afghan War by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In 2010, the Citizens United ruling from the Supreme Court allowed unlimited contributions from corporations and unions to political candidates, purportedly independent of their campaigns. In April of this year, the court's McCutcheon decision overturned aggregate limits on campaign donations by individuals to both national parties and federal candidate committees. Both decisions equated money with free speech. Many bills have been introduced in Congress to try to scale back the impact of big money in politics. One measure being proposed is a constitutional amendment introduced by Senator Tom Udall, Democrat of New Mexico, that would give Congress power to regulate the raising and spending of money in federal elections and provide state legislatures with similar authority over state elections, including setting limits on both the amount someone may contribute to candidates and the amount candidates may spend. A Judiciary Committee hearing on June 5th attracted media attention, as well as the participation of the Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate. In what insiders called a highly unusual appearance, Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid testified for the bill, and Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell testified against it. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with the group People for the American Way. Here she explains that passage of the Udall bill would be a first step in a long process to reclaim American democracy for all people, not just the wealthy few.
Up until the radical decision in Citizens United, and then in a way it's even more radical decision in the McCutcheon case, the Supreme Court was interpreting the First Amendment in a way that folks might have disagreed with the fundamental proposition about money equaling speech, but they hadn't yet used that doctrine to totally dismantle the campaign finance system. What happened in Citizens United, now McCutcheon, is it's clear that this court is determined to dismantle the campaign finance system using its interpretation of the First Amendment. And what we think is that interpretation of the First Amendment is fundamentally wrong, and we need to restore the First Amendment to what it's intended to be there for all people, not just the privileged and the powerful. And I think what we have is a Supreme Court that has really run roughshod over the First Amendment, and what we need to do now with this amendment is restore the First Amendment to its intended purpose.
The Udall Amendment so far has no Republican co-sponsors, and it seems unlikely to garner any in the current Congress, so passage looks bleak.
As you may know, there are 16 states now that are on record, either through ballot initiative or votes of the state legislatures, in support of an amendment, basically calling on their congressional delegations to support amending the Constitution to overturn Citizens United and related cases. And in a number of those state legislatures, you have Republicans voting for this kind of resolution. I think there's more than 100. So at the state level, there is Republican support for this. And then the other important fact is that when these initiatives go to the polls. In Colorado and Montana, the voters statewide voted on an initiative calling on their congressional delegation to support an amendment. And in cities across the country, including large cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, in all of those votes, they win by 75%. 75% or upwards of the people voting support a constitutional amendment. Well, when you get those numbers, that means that this is bipartisan. So at the grassroots level, at the citizen level, it's bipartisan. In state legislatures, you get Republican support. We haven't yet gotten there in the U.S. Congress, but I think we will. I think we will, because I think that people are demanding it.
Marge Baker, a constitutional amendment requires a vote by two-thirds of the members of both houses of Congress, then ratification by three-quarters of the state legislatures. As we know from the failed Equal Rights Amendment decades ago, this process is a long slog that doesn't always even end in victory. There's no other way to deal with the problem of money in politics?
Actually, there's not. I mean, it's ambitious and audacious, but when the Supreme Court has so distorted what the First Amendment is, then you have two choices. You amend the Constitution, or you change who sits on the Supreme Court and change the jurisprudence of the court. And those two aren't inconsistent. A campaign for a constitutional amendment based on this notion that the American people want representative government. They want to believe that this is a government of the people, that organizing around that to amend the Constitution to do that also lifts up the public discussion we need to have about whether the court got it right, so that when new justices are confirmed to the Supreme Court, it becomes part of the discussion, it becomes part of the issue. What view of the First Amendment do these justices hold? Do they also want to potential new justices, do they also want to restore the First Amendment, as we would through a constitutional amendment? So the two are very important. They go hand in hand, and the ERA is a perfect example. I mean, I actually believe we will get to being able to pass this constitutional amendment. And even though the ERA wasn't successful, the discussion about equal rights for women produced a whole host of both court decisions that opened up equal rights for women, as well as legislation. So this is an interchange between the court, the Constitution, and the American public, and the cultural change that needs to happen. So basically the views of the people now become preeminent, and the views of five justices sitting on the Supreme Court are not, in terms of what this Constitution and what this democracy is all about.
There have been other bills in Congress that take a different approach, like the Sarbanes bill in the House that promotes public funding.
I think these are all important. I mean, I think there is long-term, ambitious, long-range organizing that has to go on to amend the Constitution. At the same time, we also ought to be pushing for everything that we can do to make the current situation better. And that absolutely includes a Sarbanes governed by the people, small donor bill. It includes disclosed legislation. It includes administrative actions. There's a whole host of things that we can do to make the current situation better, and we should try to do that. We absolutely should try to do that. And we actually believe that sort of the backdrop of the framing how important this issue is by talking about a constitutional amendment helps lift and add an energy to those efforts as well. So this is full court press on every front that we can possibly act on.
Well, it's a long view because two-thirds in each house is far from where the vote would be if it were held now.
That's correct. But organizing and raising up this issue and raising this notion that we need representative government, which is absolutely at the core of Senator Sarbanes' Governed by the People small donor bill. Those two interchange. And so maybe in the short run we get a Governed by the People Act passed, right, as we're continuing to organize for the constitutional amendment. And that will make things much, much better if we got that passed.
That was Marge Baker of People for the American Way. Find links to groups engaged in the fight against unregulated money in politics by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Shama Sawant was elected to Seattle City Council in November 2013, it was the first time a member of a socialist party had won a citywide election in nearly 100 years. The former software engineer, originally from Mumbai, India, ran for office advocating increasing the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour, taxing the rich, and reimposing a rent control ordinance. In her surprising victory, Sawant defeated Richard Conlon, a four-term Democratic council member and past president of the city council. Growing up in India, Sawant had witnessed grinding poverty firsthand, and when she moved to the U.S., she was surprised to find that the wealthiest nation in the world had so many homeless people and inadequate social service programs to assist those in need. The inequality she found in America motivated her to pursue a new career studying economics in North Carolina, where she earned a Ph.D. Sawant moved to Seattle in 2006 and became involved with Socialist Alternative, a political party originally formed under the name Labor Militant in 1986. Sawant helped organize the local Occupy Wall Street movement when it spread to Seattle in the fall of 2011. In November 2012, she entered electoral politics for the first time, challenging incumbent Washington State Speaker of the House Frank Chop, ultimately losing to him by a 70-29% margin. Your reporter spoke with Shama Sawant in New York City just 2 days before the city council unanimously voted to approve Seattle's $15 an hour minimum wage, the highest in the nation. Here she talks about the important elements of her successful campaign and the lessons that can be learned from her experience by other progressive activists across the U.S.
Our electoral campaign itself was not something that I decided to do on an individual basis. And I think that is an important lesson that I would like to share with everybody on the left who's looking to understanding how is it that we can build an independent challenge to the Democrats, and how is it that we can build mass movements that can win substantial reforms while calling for systemic change. And that lesson is that we need to break from careerist politicians and that idea of politics, you know, that sort of the bourgeois politics where political campaigns are primarily in the service of enriching individual careers, where the good of humanity, the fight for the working class, is always sacrificed for the more expedient question of, you know, well, I need to build links with this business or that business, I need to stay good with this or that wealthy person. And it's always rationalized on that basis. And so just, you know, having well-meaning people who engage in Democratic Party politics is not the answer, because it's not good intentions of that kind, that good intentions that are always rationalized away in the service of the existing, the status quo, is not what we need. That is exactly what is harmful to us. And so what Socialist Alternative did in running our campaign is showed that what we need is an independent force for the working class that will challenge the Democratic Party, that will propel movements forward, and that will stand candidates in elections who are not driven by their personal gain or any desires for their personal careers, but are purely offering themselves as an as representatives for the interests of the working class. We also want this campaign and the success of my election campaign to serve as an inspiration to many young people all across the country who will hopefully see this as the seed of something more to come, and that we don't want me to be the last working class candidate. We want this to be the beginning of something big.
Your success in Seattle, running as a socialist and using the $15 an hour campaign as kind of your banner, can that whole success be transplanted to other places around the country? Or is Seattle very special in terms of its culture, counterculture, the youth culture, places like Berkeley and San Francisco and Portland, the whole sort of Northwest Coast maybe looked at as quite different from the rest of the country. Do you think what you accomplished can work elsewhere?
Well, I have no doubt that there are many unique features in Seattle that you probably won't find in, I don't know, Houston, Texas, or somewhere like that. You know, there is a cultural distance between different places in the United States. Certainly, Seattle is decisively much more liberal and progressive. The struggle for gay rights has gained, you know, tremendous ascendancy in Seattle and in Washington State. You know, Washington State in 2012 passed Referendum 74, which upheld marriage equality, and we also passed a law that ended the criminalization of marijuana possession. And so there's no doubt that there are features that are unique to Seattle. But I would say that about any place. You know, every place has unique features. New York City has its unique features that can't be replicated in Seattle. And while those features certainly play a role, I would say that those are not the ones that drive political changes. They may play a role, but primarily what is driving political change is the same is in any class system, in any system that relies on oppression and exploitation. The social conditions engineered by that system are also the engineers of the need for political activism.
What is it that you think can be learned by the rest of the country in terms of that $15 threshold? Do you think a critical mass was reached by what you accomplished in Seattle? And can that campaign, do you have indications there are cities around the country that are moving right now to pressure their own city officials to go for a $15 minimum wage?
Yeah, we know that, you know, Chicago, for example, is making a headway towards that kind of demand for $15 an hour. And in fact, I would say that we're seeing the impacts of that in many ways, both directly and indirectly. And so what people are seeing is that this is a genuine voice for working people. This is not a career politician. This is not somebody who can be corrupted. And it's not somebody who's running merely on good intentions, but on the basis of this political force, Socialist Alternative, which is as an organization rooted in the working class and committed to advancing the interests of the working class. That is what will ensure that we can build upon the success.
That was Socialist Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant, leader of a successful campaign to raise her city's minimum wage to $15 an hour, the highest in the nation. Find links to more information on the minimum wage campaign, the Socialist Alternative Party, and other related stories by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.